Welcome, Alyssa. Could you briefly introduce yourself? What type of work do you do and what year are you?
Yeah, so I am a second year PhD candidate in the Department of Animal Sciences. I did my master's at the Department of Animal Sciences at MSU as well. And I study equine exercise physiology, which is just a bunch of big words that means I look at horses as athletes. And within that, I focus mostly on bone health and how we can exercise an animal or manage them in a certain way and really impact their bone health for the better or for the worse. And we really try to come up with some new management techniques to make it for the better.
Oh, very cool. So when I think of I will admit, I don't know much about horses besides that they're majestic. But horses, I realize there's a zillion different breeds of horses, but it seems like race horses to me, are there different types of race horses versus other,
Absolutely. That's a fantastic
yeah.
question. Because actually, a lot of my research is with the racing industry. They do a fantastic job funding research to reduce injuries and increase better management practices. But yeah, there are definitely different types. So in Michigan, we actually have standard bred racing, which is like cart horses. Not a lot of people really have seen that. It's not super popular, but in Michigan, that's what we have. And then there's your like Kentucky Derby thoroughbreds. That's what's really common, and they go longer races. And then there's quarter horses, which, for lack of a better term, just say really briefly, they run about a quarter mile. It's a really quick sprint. And so those aren't really as televised and seen as often really as the thoroughbred that everybody knows when they think of racing.
What was the first one you said? You said cart horses?
Yeah, so the breed is a standard bred.
Okay.
And it's really cool. We have a fantastic herd of retired standard bred racehorses at MSU, actually. And they're not like just horses that didn't make it. Like they're horses that made it. There's one individually, he won $1 million on the track, and we get to use him for research, and they're also just fantastic to work with.
Oh, very cool. So, another question. So, when it comes to horse racing, how much is horse dependent versus the jockey that is riding the horse?
That's
What
a
is the
fantastic question. And not even just horse racing, but any type of competition with horses and dogs and really any animal that you're competing with. Genetics definitely plays a role. The horse really needs to have the right environment. They need to have the right conformation and kind of like the right heart for it, the right drive to want to do it. So a great, phenomenal, amazing horse, a lot of times the exhibitor is there to assist that horse show to their best or to race to their best. There are some other horses that they're phenomenal, but only if they're really encouraged by the jockey or the exhibitor. And then there's some horses that it's just not their thing and they're not going to do so well. But I mean, on the other end, you could have an amazing horse and the jockey just gets in the way. So it really is the amazing, phenomenal, like top horses. Their jockey absolutely has to help them and encourage them to go in the right direction and time things correctly. But they're pretty fantastic athletes on their own. They just have to have somebody ride them. We had an issue in a race a couple, just like 2 years ago, where a jockey came off right at the beginning. And it was really cool to see the horse stay with the herd, but obviously couldn't really finish.
Okay. Very cool. Every time that I talk to someone who is involved with the equine sciences, I feel like you can't just be into the equine sciences without also having a horse in your life that you grew up
Yeah.
with. So I'm assuming were horses, involved with your life early
They
on?
were. I didn't, so I did grow up with horses. But I don't come from like a horse family at all. I was just that kind of horse kid that whenever we were driving somewhere, I'd point them out and I had this adorable little like carousel horse on springs that was in my room and I would race it when I was like 2 years old. And my parents were wonderful and realized that this wasn't just a phase. And they started by, when I was really young, kind of feeding me books and the right kind of educational things on TV. And I just kept wanting to do it more and more. So they slowly got more involved. And we're fortunate that we had some property. So we brought our horses home And so I was fortunate enough to have horses from the time I was 12 until now. And I still have two horses. And I have I'm really lucky that I get to continue to be a part of horses during grad school because it's really expensive. Mm-hmm. But if you do it right, it doesn't have to be. So I kind of made a decision to turn in my amateur status last year and am a judge and give lessons and train some horses professionally. And that is really fun and financially a great choice.
Are you from the Michigan area?
Yeah, I'm from Oakland County, which actually has a really large horse population. So I'm not from super far from where MSU is.
Okay. Yeah, that because I could see if you then went to school elsewhere, you know, that is one more hassle.
I did actually go do my undergrad in Wisconsin, and I did bring a horse with me. It was actually really fun.
Okay.
Riding in the winter was cool.
So if you're in Wisconsin with your horse, where does your horse, is there like a university place that you can do a horse? You have to do some private area.
Some universities are set up that students can bring their horses to campus. Where I went, it was very similar to MSU that it's only the college owned horses on campus, and it makes more of a liability for the university and some biosecurity. So my horse was boarded privately, 5 minutes off campus. And it was kind of nice because I was on the campus farms all the time for work and school. So it was kind of nice to just have I'm going to go somewhere quiet and have my horse and ride and focus.
Okay. And so you said your studies were in animal sciences, right?
Yes. Animal science.
Okay. So once again, that's probably a broad thing. Yeah. So I'm guessing you did it and some sort of equine focus. Is that where you kind of started?
So a lot of universities have an animal science degree and you take a lot of broad classes. I took dairy nutrition courses and some swine genetic courses, but my focus was equine. So in terms of management and production courses, you choose a species, and my species was horse, but I have had a decent background in a variety of other animals, poultry and meat processing, which actually really helps in terms of horses to just learn about everything.
Okay. So I came to know you because I attended the graduate academic conference that the COGS put on, and you talked a little bit about measuring the force of when a horse's steps. Mm-hmm. Can you explain, give a little brief spiel of what you talked about?
So great to attend the GAC put on by CAGS. And this actually is a little bit newer research to me. My master's research was doing physical things with bones, taking CT scans and putting them in tensile tests. But horses, in terms of research in the US, we cannot do terminal studies with them very easily. So any measurements that we do need to be just on a live horse. And in terms of looking at a horse and just watching them move, you can look, an experienced individual, like a researcher, a veterinarian, can look at that animal and be able to assign some traits to it. Might be able to compare to another animal and say, okay, this one is better, or this leg looks worse. But they're really, really not quantitative data. That's just kind of me subjectively saying I like X over Y. And so something that can really help with research is being able to put quantitative data to how a horse is moving. And one such technology is these sensor pads that we put on a horse's hoof, and you can adhere it in multiple different ways. We use a glue-on shoe, and that sensor can output the force, area, and pressure of every single stride that horse is taking. So it is really cool to say, actually, yes, that horse, that leg does look worse. And when we look at the data, they're putting less pressure on it, or they're putting more pressure on it. They're using it differently. So that's what my research is doing for my PhD. First, we still are working with the sensors to get them to be really durable and usable on a horse, because horses weigh a lot and you can't really put something on them and say, okay, now step very, very carefully and step the same every single time. So we're working with that. But once we have a perfected our method of adherence, we're actually going to be, the reason that we started these studies is to look at circular exercise in horses. And this is a phenomenon in people too, like people that are running on the track. And determining if you're exercising in a circle, how does speed and the size of it change how the horse is loading? So obviously if you're in a big circle, it might not have nearly as much like torque as if you're in a smaller circle, and same with speed.
Okay. Cause, like there's, I mean, like when they do races and stuff, like, I'm guessing there's like zero banking, like it's all just flat surfaces.
It depends. So actually the thing that's really cool about the cart horses is those tracks, because it is a cart, they're banked almost like a NASCAR race. And so banking can happen, but it's also really common, not just in racing, but in industry, like me, as let's say, you know, I just bought a horse and I'm a little newer to this and I'm not super comfortable getting on my horse right away. It's a really warm spring day and they need to run around a little bit. So we could put them on a long line, like maybe 30 feet of line, and it's called lunging, where you just lunge them in a circle for a little bit, let them run around and buck before you get on them. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely a safe practice to utilize. But we're just curious about how does that impact their legs? We just don't know. Mm-hmm. And it's something that the industry has really asked. So we said, yes, let's answer this for you.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Yeah. Do you, probably another dumb question, do they always go like the same direction in the circle, like, you know, counterclockwise?
Not a dumb question at all. Yeah. When racing, yes. It's the same direction. We don't really change directions while we're racing. Mm-hmm. But in terms of just exercising our horse, both directions are usually exercised equally. Okay. And to throw another thing into a mix, there's another style of riding that it's actually why I got into the circular exercise research, because it's what I do. And it's called reining. And what it's known for is these phenomenal circles that the horses run, and you have speed changes, and these horses do these really cool slides and spins. But a lot of the training of that does use small circular exercise. And there might be an incidence of osteoarthritis in those animals that could be tied to that. The connection hasn't been quite made in research, but the demographics are there to suggest that maybe that's what's going on. Like the circles are maybe causing it. So it's something that is definitely interesting to look into. In terms of racing, like the turns are a little bit more gradual than what we see in some other competitive sports, but they're going way faster. So there's a lot that could be going on there.
So all of your work and stuff, like how translatable is it from, you know, I asked resources because that's, you know, what I can't remember you talking about, but how's that different from like the horses that do, you know, the jumpy events, or like, I don't know what it's called.
Just but, like your backyard horse, right? Like your everyday horse.
Sure.
But yeah, or the jumping horses, but super relatable. And I will absolutely say the racing industry, I'm so thankful for it, because that's where we get a lot of our attention. And that's where a lot of our funding comes from. But just because we might be researching something that is kind of a background in racing does not mean it's not applicable to everybody else. Actually, funding for my current project came from the American Quarter Horse Association, which they do racing, absolutely. But they have a huge group that is recreational that does like trail riding and just kind of working and ranching. But they also have a huge group that is showing and competitive horses that is like, you know, jumping and reining and all kinds of other stuff. So while a lot of the funds come from research, we also have a lot of interest from everybody else. And we actually get a lot of funding from the Michigan Alliance for Animal Agriculture, which is not horse specific at all. Just funds the advancement of animal agriculture in Michigan. So they do poultry and bovine research. So it definitely is applicable to the regular horse. And it's in terms of like my previous bone research, I mean, to dumb it down even more, like bone is bone really. So we found that, I don't want to digress too much, but like in a young animal, we kind of want to protect them and, you know, stay nice and stay quiet, but actually it's best to just let them be an animal and let them be outside and run around. So an animal that is confined does actually lose bone strength. And if they're allowed to just undergo one sprint about 71 meters a day, they can increase bone strength by 24%. And that actually we used a calf for, because we can't terminate horses, but it's applicable to the racing industry, to the individuals that are sale prepping young horses, to just keep in mind that allowing those horses to have exercise prepares them better for a career. And even just the 4-H rider that is starting with a young horse, just recognizing that, yeah, they could go on pasture too. That's good for them. So we definitely, for me, getting things to industry and your everyday horse owner is super important, not just the big racing guys, because they get a lot of help already.
Yeah. Very cool. And I kind of want to like touch on a little comment that you made, because I was going to bring this up when I was looking at like your like profile on the department website. Mm-hmm. That one of the articles featured was about cows.
Yes.
Or so I was just a little curious, because it was
briefly
glancing. It was like racing on like racing cows instead or something. Yep. And I'm like, that a cow doesn't seem very racer friendly.
Yes, definitely. So we use calves as a model for young horses on a lot of our bone studies, because they are an animal that we can use in terminal studies. And there's so much information that we can get when we can actually manipulate the bone and put it through tensile testing and actually take samples straight from cartilage, which we can't really do from a live horse. So we get so much information. It's so helpful. And they've been proven to be a really helpful model for a young horse in terms of, obviously, digestively, they're very different and not helpful that way. But in terms of exercise, we love calves. And I have more calves that'll be on research for me in the next month or two, hopefully.
Very cool. I want to ask one more probably this silly question, but can you explain to me horseshoes? Like why horseshoes?
That's a great question.
Horseshoes, why? What and why?
Absolutely. So I will say I am not a farrier at all, which is someone that puts on shoes and trims horses' feet. But we collaborate with a fantastic farrier that we have on campus, Dave Halleck, who works with us really closely in our research. So I will say the reason that I discuss shoes a little bit in my research is because those sensors, they have to be put on the horse's hoof some way. And typically a horseshoe is nailed on, and it really like scares people to see like, why are we nailing things into a live animal?
Yeah.
And they don't have feeling in that part of our hoof. So it'd be like me like sticking a nail through like my hair right now. Like it's annoying, but I'm not going to feel it. When used correctly, which farriers are trained extensively to use them correctly, they stay on really well and can really help an animal if they need them. So in our studies, we don't use a glue-on shoe because it'll kill the we don't use a nail-on shoe because it'll kill the sensors to put a nail through it. So we just use a nifty little glue-on shoe. But horseshoes, not all horses need them. Some horses can go their whole life and not need them at all. If you think about it, we have horses in the wild that live out west and do really well without them. They're tracking on rocky terrain and undergo natural wear. But when we manage them in a little bit smaller area and confine them a little bit, and we have nice lushy grass pastures, they don't get as much wear on the hoof. So a farrier will have to trim the hoof to the correct shape, just like cutting our fingernails. If you're someone that works with wood a lot or does a lot of sanding, you really don't need to trim your fingernails a lot because they're getting worn down. But if you're someone who isn't doing a lot of manual work, your fingernails are probably going to need to be trimmed because they get really annoying when you're trying to type on your computer. So some horses for a job that they do might need to wear shoes. It's pretty typical that racehorses are required to wear shoes at tracks. It could give them a little bit better grip. For certain events, certain shoes are required. So in reining, the event that I mentioned, the horses on their back feet, they have a shoe that's almost like a ski, and it allows them to perform a sliding stop, which without like a video or anything to describe, like for the podcast, it's basically that the horse runs and then they stop suddenly and their back feet just slide like on a ski while their front feet are still running.
Okay.
So there are some shoes. So the purpose, the right reason I brought that up is there are some shoes that allow a horse to perform a specific task. And shoes can also be used correctively just like putting an orthotic in like our shoes as people, you know, to correct maybe bad arches or if you have knee problems, make you feel a little bit better. So they can be used correctively. If you have an animal that is trail riding a lot or riding on really rough terrain and their hoofs aren't holding up to it very well, a shoe might be helpful. But then some horses can hold up to that totally fine without shoes. So when they're needed, they're awesome and really helpful, and not everybody needs them. They're a great tool that we have, that's for sure.
Okay, very interesting. Very cool.
Yeah, the nails don't hurt, I promise.
Okay.
They can like if they're put in wrong, but they're going into just keratin, really, or biotin.
Okay, yeah, because it's like, I don't know. If I step on a nail, like, that would hurt.
And if a horse does step on a nail, because they have, like, a sensitive, like, sole, that does not feel good at all. But it's just that outer wall that's like fingernail material and they don't have nerves.
Oh, okay. So it's like if I'm looking at the hoof like hood on, it's more like straight on. Mm-hmm. It's more like a ring.
Yeah. Yeah. That's okay. A great way to describe it. There's like a, almost like if you picture like cutting a cross section of a cell, it's like you have that cell membrane or cell wall on the outside. And that would be like your like hoof wall that isn't sensitive. And then the inside you have sensitive growing stuff.
Oh, okay. Okay. I guess that makes that explains, you know, a little bit of why, you know, the horseshoe is kind of U-shaped,
yes,
you know,
as opposed to exactly.
Like a solid plate.
Yes.
Okay. Very cool. Very cool. So when you were an undergrad, did you always kind of know that you wanted to like go into like this equine things, or you're like, oh, I just want to do animal science and it kind of goes in this direction? Did you consider like other fields going into undergrad?
Definitely. I thought that I wanted to go to vet school when I started undergrad. And my end goal never changed. So when I started undergrad and told myself, like, yeah, I want to be a veterinarian, what I wanted was to be a veterinarian and then get a specialty in sports medicine within veterinary medicine and then be able to work for a university doing research. And so it was a long, drawn out process to that. And then one day, my sophomore year, one of our fantastic faculty, we kind of had like a career discussion in one of our advanced equine classes. And she was talking about grad school and my jaw just like dropped. And I was like, wait a minute, I can just go straight to the research. Like, this is so cool. So at that moment, I was just like hook, line and sinker. I really want to go to grad school. That's what I want to do. And I actually got in contact with my current advisor now, who I had met before quite a few times and doing some things at MSU. And he was like, oh yeah, we can, you know, we do these studies here and let's stay in contact and see, you know, if your grades look good enough, let's see about you coming here to MSU. And so I'm really thankful that I had a really early personal contact with somebody and that I could kind of discuss with, okay, what are you looking for in a grad student? What are some things you want me to do in my last years of undergrad? So that getting into grad school, was kind of just a natural progression for me.
Okay. How did you meet the MSU people?
So MSU Extension does a lot with 4-H. And when I was in middle school and high school, I was in 4-H and did a lot of stuff through 4-H. So by contact through MSU, I had just been lucky enough to listen to a seminar that my advisor, Dr. Brian Nielsen, had put on just the basics of equine exercise science. And I was like, wow, this was really cool. We should like, you know, see if we can talk to this guy. So my mom, I was really young. So my mom like sent him an email and got in contact with him. And we just had a little meeting about what is exercise science when I was in high school. So I knew him, he knew me, like we just kind of kept in contact when I was in college. And he actually had suggested where I go where I went to undergrad, because it was just, it fit my goals a little bit better than MSU. So we had stayed in contact all through my undergrad. And when I realized, like, I think I really want to go to grad school, it became an even better fit to continue to stay in contact and study under him. Okay. So it was a much more personal relationship than most individuals have with their advisor, and a very early relationship, but got really lucky that there were people at MSU that helped me to stay in contact with the right people and go to the right place. And I really appreciate individuals for saying that maybe MSU wasn't actually right for me for undergrad, and I was able to come back for grad school, but I really appreciated that.
Very cool. When you were an undergrad, were you ever a part of like any clubs or organizations outside of like classes and research?
For sure. So many. I did a lot of things.
Awesome.
Undergrad was a great time. Oh, go ahead. What was that?
Oh, I was like, great. I want to hear them.
Yeah. Undergrad was a great time. And I actually am still in contact with a lot of my friends from undergrad, but I was on the, throw another abbreviation at you. It's called IHSA, which is Intercollegiate Horse Show Association. So it was just a group of people showing horses. And the cool thing about that, you don't have to own a horse, and it's structured for college students, because a lot of us, even if maybe we did bring a horse, we're not able to go haul our horse every weekend and go to shows, because it is expensive. But it's structured as like a catch ride system. So you show up to a university, and MSU has a team. So you show up to a university, and that home team provides all of the horses that everyone shows that day, and you draw a name out of a hat. And that's who you're going to show for the day. And you've never been on that horse, and you get on it and show in your place. There's classes that are separated by different experience levels of riders. So I was with that team the whole time I was in undergrad, and learned a lot about riding and had so much fun. I got to ride so many cool horses, very different than the horses I was used to riding. And it was so much fun. And it definitely makes you a better rider to just get on something and go. And our practices were focused on building that toolbox and that ability to have the confidence to just get on something and go and say, yep, I've dealt with this before. I have these skills. Let's just ride. And they're all safe horses. They're not throwing any broncos at us, not too often anyways. So I was with that team, and that took a lot of my time. We had practices a couple times a week and shows on weekend. There was a broader horse group on campus called Horsemen's Association, and that's for anybody to join that just wants to do horse things. And we would do different events together and help manage the farms and help run some shows. I did some undergraduate research, which is really funny. I was not expecting to, and it was involving calves. And part of that like fueled my like calf research and my master's too. But because I was in Wisconsin, I did know that I wanted to do a little bit, like just maybe help on a research project before I went to undergrad. And they had a cool program like MSU does to apply for just some small undergrad grants, maybe $1,000 to provide the resources for like some blood tubes. So I applied for a grant for that. And the only animals available to do research with were calves, because we were in Wisconsin. So I looked at the palatability of vanilla flavoring on calf starter. Which, like, the results were really inconclusive, and it was just a little study, but I learned how to handle calves and just got familiar with grant writing, which really has helped me in grad school to already know how to write grants coming in. Gosh, what else did I do in undergrad? I had a really cool job. I worked for technology services, which, like, I'm not really a technology person. Like, I can get around what we need to do in grad school, but it was all about communication with people. Like, I was at the front end answering phones of angry people when projectors went down or their emails weren't going through. And learning how to communicate with those people is a big skill for grad school, for sure. So that was fun. And it was really cool because it was on campus, and they set it up that, like, if you had an hour break before class, you could just go work. So that was actually a really great way to continue to fund the horse things. I think that's pretty much it that I did in undergrad.
Oh, super cool. All sorts of different stuff.
Yeah.
What does showing a horse entail, actually?
Anything you want it to.
Okay.
There's so much variety in what you can do. Like the first thing that you had said earlier with an example was like jumping. So there's jumping. There's rail classes where you're not jumping and just on the riding your horse on the rail. There's classes that there's specific obstacles and patterns that you're given that you have to perform and are judged on. And then there's classes that are judged. You're there as an exhibitor, but it's completely on the horse and how your horse is put together and your horse moves and how they are a breed standard. And the cool thing about it is there's so many different levels. There's 4-H and open shows that happen all across Michigan and all across the U.S. every weekend. And they're $5 to enter and $20 for a stall. Really affordable. And then there's huge, big national shows that are $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. You go show and you train really hard and you travel all over the United States and all over the country. So there's such a huge variety that anyone can really get involved that is interested. They have some phenomenal just grassroots level things and great stepping stones to work your way up if you desire to. There's so much in showing. You can get really specific and go to a show that is all one breed of horse, or you can go to a show that is all doing one class of riding. You can go to a show that's all miniature horses, which are so cute and adorable.
Sounds ideal.
Yes, and they even have like cart classes for them. Like, those are really cute. Those are cool because anybody, whether they are able-bodied or not, can get involved with horses. So like, yes, they have the miniature horses, but at the American Quarter Horse Congress, which is the largest single breed show, they have classes for equestrians with disabilities and para riding classes to support riders at the biggest stages in the US and in the world, which I love.
Super cool. Yes. Now I am, now that I know that there's many horses.
Yeah, yes, they are.
Yes. super cool. So then you transitioned into your master's. How was that, like 2 years?
Yeah, I did my master's for 2 years.
Okay. And is that mostly classes, research, both?
Yes. My first year was a little bit more classes. My advisor sets things up so nicely that your first year is classes, some writing, and learning a little bit of lab techniques to get comfortable with it. And then your second year, you just hit the ground running with your research. So it was a little bit, it wasn't like super course intensive. I think I took like 4 courses, but for grad school, that seems like a lot compared to undergrad. I think I've taken 1 class in my PhD, which I'm totally okay with.
Yeah.
I'm good to be done with classes.
So then with your PhD stuff, how far are you into your PhD?
I'm in my second year.
Okay.
And my master's and PhD, they kind of like rolled together. Like, I absolutely like ended my master's and defended and graduated and finished that. But like during my master's, I wrote the grants for my PhD and like planned all the research for it. So they kind of bleed together.
Okay. During kind of your grad school stint here, then have you been a part of any like what or your extracurriculars outside of, outside of classes and research?
Definitely. So I actually am, we have a really cool grad student organization, as most departments do. We have the Animal Science Graduate Student Association that I'm a part of. We have monthly meetings, and I have held e-board positions in that and sit on a few cool committees. I actually am on the COGS e-board. I'm the treasurer for COGS, which is really cool to get to be a part of that. That is such a cool organization, and man, they are movers and shakers there. So that's what I do on campus. I teach too. I often have a teaching assistantship to help support funding my research. Off campus, it's all horse for me. So I'm a apprentice trainer out of DMB Performance Horses in Mason. And I started that, I made the big leap and turned in all my amateur cards this past June. So I've been doing that for about half a year, and I have a few in training horses there. I have my personal horses, and I give lessons every day and really have a bunch on the weekend and go to shows. But the nice thing is it's not really separate from what I'm doing at MSU with my research. They really go together. And my program is very pro us being involved in the industry that we are working in, because it's really to make recommendations to the industry and not realizing like, oh, that is not going to work, or like, oh, they're already doing that. So I just wasted a lot of time and a lot of money. Super like not work or anything like that. I really enjoy like kayaking and hiking and camping. We have like Sleepy Hollow State Park that's by us at MSU. That's such a cool state park. Mm-hmm.
Anything outside. Very, very cool. Could you explain a little bit of, for like maybe those who don't know, like your role in COGS and just kind of like what COGS is in general?
Yeah, absolutely. So COGS is the Council of Graduate Students, and their mission is to advocate for graduate students in terms of your program, your health and your program, your social health, your emotional health, your physical health, and any finances that we can help with too. So we do a lot of resolutions that can help. So me, I definitely know more about the funding because I'm the treasurer, but we do support a lot of programs too. So like one thing that we do is we can help fund you if you're going to conferences, if you're going to present or just going to network and do professional development. We can fund graduate student organization events, and we've still been doing all of that in the virtual sphere. There's still plenty of things to fund. Maybe we're not traveling as much, but conference registration is still expensive online. You don't really want to spend $300 to be a part of Zoom meetings, so we can help fund that for you. We are in a lot of communication with student affairs and the graduate school and ASMSU as well, actually, to represent grad students in many different ways all across campus. And especially now at MSU, it kind of feels like you might feel like you're swimming in underwater with everything that's going on being virtual, but you're definitely still represented, and we definitely look out for our grad students in the best way that we can.
Great. How did you get involved in serving in, you know, this position or getting involved with COGS?
Most graduate student organizations, I'd like to say all, but I don't think all do. One of your e-board members usually represents organization at a COGS meeting. So last year I was the vice president of our departmental organization, and that's our COGS representative. So I went to all the meetings last year and really liked the large impact that COGS had in the university. So I chatted with the e-board, and they kind of helped me find that actually being on e-board might be a good fit. I was a little worried about it in terms of the time commitment with research, but it's very doable and very flexible time.
Very good. Yes, I am a big supporter of COGS. I enjoy like all the events and resources that they provide. It's all very, very great.
Yeah, it honestly is a really fun group. I know as grad students, we get so focused on like our research, and it's like, oh, you know, I don't have time to do this kind of stuff. But you do, you really do. Yeah. Even like 5 minutes to just like listen in on what we're doing is helpful.
Yeah, I do like that it's like for all grad students for the university, because I feel like that is a big way of knowing, you know, because I was like, you know, in physics for me, it's like, okay, I only ever see physics people all the time. And it's like, it's great to, you know, see what other people are doing or just like meet other people.
Yes. And I say, and you know, we say grad students, and in COGS, we define grad students as like the professional and the law students and nursing students and vet students too. So if anybody's listening, you were definitely included on that. Mm-hmm. But hearing what they're doing in different colleges and how they're dealing with issues, how they're taking funding or how they're continuing to do social events is really helpful.
Yeah. Awesome. So then I guess I can start wrapping up. Do you have like any advice or, you know, things that you wish you had known, like transitioning from undergrad to grad school?
I think the biggest thing for me, which sounds counterintuitive to say it because I'm from Michigan, but I still went away for undergrad, is do not let location restrict you. I actually got really lucky that the program that I really wanted to do happened to be in Michigan. I was from Michigan. Cool. That's awesome. But if I had to go to Florida or Texas or California, I absolutely would have. And I did go away to Wisconsin for undergrad, but I've seen so many individuals, even grad students who are at the end of their career and they get offered a faculty position somewhere, that location scares them. And I absolutely understand that. Family is so important. I got really lucky that my husband is from Michigan as well. But if you are in this position and have spent so much time on your education, you are worth that position that you got offered, wherever it may be. And the science community really, it can make itself small too, through communication and through publications that everybody has together. So you definitely won't be lost if you go to somewhere new. Now it may not be the perfect fit. So don't absolutely, turn up your life if you don't think that it's the right fit. But in terms of going to a grad program or undergrad, if you are so passionate about it and it really seems to be something that you want to put all of your time and your energy into, then location is a small thing. It really is, because that location will become a place that you love.
Okay.
That's definitely the big one for me.
Okay. Oh, Sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Very, very good. So I like that advice. How did you end up at Wisconsin then? Like, why was that the place that spoke to you?
So they have, it's a little bit smaller university. It's not crazy small. Like, it was like 8,500 total.
Which
undergrads
on
campus. UW River Falls.
Okay.
So it's so far west in Wisconsin that, like, if you're going to the grocery store, you can often accidentally go to Minnesota. That happened to me a lot my freshman year. I'd like cross the bridge and it's like, crap, I'm in Minnesota again. So, but for me, it was an agriculture school that they had a equine program that was centered around the reining industry. They had a lot of options. Some schools you go to and you're either going to go there and learn to become a trainer, or you're going to learn the sciences. They had options to be right in the middle. You could lean a little bit one way, lean a little bit the other way. They just had a lot more flexible program development for yourself. And I actually did my undergrad in 3 years. I was able to really kick it out and do a lot over the summer. They had a separate like winter term that you could take courses during. So they were so flexible and they really wanted you to get your education in any way that you wanted to. And their specific equine focus and the faculty they had there really just matched for me. And I was riding almost every single day while taking classes, which definitely was huge for me. MSU, we're just so big. It's so hard to offer that kind of education to everybody. And I don't think that's a fault of MSU at all. I think MSU has some fantastic resources because it is so big. Like, I wasn't able to take part in a lot of research because where I went to undergrad wasn't, you know, a medical school or anything like that. But at MSU, we have the vet school, we have hundreds of labs, we have osteopathic medicine. So students have those opportunities. I didn't have that opportunity in undergrad. My research was drawing blood on calves and I had to work really hard to make that happen. But I was able to have a little bit more unique program experience. And it was just a gorgeous area. When I visited campus, it was like, yep, I'm happy here. This is comfortable.
Very cool. Does Wisconsin, so like, I think of Wisconsin and you think of like cows.
Mm-hmm.
Are there really a lot of cows in Wisconsin, or is that just kind of like a trope?
Yeah. Cows everywhere.
Okay.
And it's not like you drive through Wisconsin and it's just like cow, 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 cow. Like, it's a lot like Michigan where you drive through and there's some cities and there's some spurts of farmland, but instead of spurts of crops, you just see a lot more dairy farm.
Okay. Is there any particular reason as to why there?
I'm going to be honest, I'm not a dairy scientist.
Okay.
I probably should know that, but I think the environment is right in terms of what's comfortable for cows. It's not like crazy, crazy hot. They can undergo heat stress and the soil is right for the right kind of forage for them, from my understanding. And now that like the industry is there, it's there. And same with California too. They're a pretty big dairy state, but like Texas, like they have a little bit more like beef cattle. So like they're able to have cattle, but Texas doesn't do so well with the dairy cattle because it's not as productive an environment for dairy cattle to be producing milk at a high rate. But Michigan isn't like to ignore in the dairy industry. We don't have nearly as many cows as everybody else, but our milk quality is a lot better. And again, I'm not a dairy scientist. That is okay. From listening to the dairy scientists in my department.
Okay.
So just, you can like kind of quote me on that, but don't really quote me on that.
Okay. I mean, you knew more than I did, so.
Yeah.
All right. Well, very good. Well, thank you for coming on and joining. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Absolutely. This was really fun. Thank you so much for letting me tell my story.